Hello, this is Charles Wiz.
And Tony Silva.
And once again, we're two teachers talking. And Tony and I, for years and years and years, 172 times today, have been talking about teaching English in Japan, what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, what we're learning, what we're not learning, what we think's important for teachers. And today we're talking about, what do you do when things go off the rails from your first class that you're teaching? And we have to, like Tony, come up with certain terminology for what we're talking about today, right?
Yeah, we do. But before we do that, how's that retirement going, Charles?
Oh, that retirement.
It's been about a month, right?
I forgot about. Well, officially, it's like about 3 weeks.
Okay.
Right, because it's officially from the beginning of April. Thanks for asking. It's nice. It's relaxing. I feel more relaxed than I felt in years. But, of course, a lot of it is I'm not commuting, you know, from where I live to Yokohama, which is kind of similar as if, you know, one was commuting from, let's say, like Los Angeles to San Francisco.
Yeah.
It's a one-hour flight. If you take a flight or a 2 hour and 15 minute, you know, bullet train ride, but it's nice not to have to do that. But one thing I do want to talk about, Tony, it's not really the retirement thing. I think I mentioned I did a final lecture.
Yes. We talked a little bit about that last month.
Did I talk about that? I'd given it?
No. It hadn't happened yet. You were still preparing.
Right. So I ended up doing it and I ended up, I had like a digital, spinning wheel that had topics in it. And every 10 minutes I would spin the wheel and it would choose a topic. And that's what I would talk about for the next 10 minutes. So that was kind of a fun thing to do. I tried to make it interesting for people, but as I've mentioned before, I was able to have seminars, you know, where I'd work with students from the second half of their junior year and all through their senior year. And I had one student who I always felt that I had just failed, that I hadn't supported them enough, that I hadn't, worked with them and helped them enough. And after they didn't end up graduating from YNU, but I really, 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 really liked this student. I really cared for them a lot. They were just, you know, a real special person. And didn't see them for years, didn't hear from them for years. And then they somehow surfaced and I got back together with them and their other two seminar classmates. And then they disappeared again. And I just felt, I've really failed this one student. I didn't do enough. And I'm not going to go into the details, but this student had a really hard time in their senior year. I think that, you know, home life was not so good. Anyway, I'm doing my final lecture, and about 15 minutes into the final lecture, he walks in. And, you know, Tony, it was one of the great moments of my life, you know, just to like, he walks in and he's carrying this huge bouquet of flowers. And I'm like, you're here. And he just says, like, of course I'm here. And, you know, it was a great thing to see. And the reason I mention this, Tony, is that I think it just reminded me clearly that, you know, we can have an impact on people, not just, you know, in teaching English or not just making somebody motivated, but, you know, after, you know, talking to him, and it just felt really good that, wow, you know, maybe I did reach somebody. Maybe I did help one person in my entire teaching career. And, you know, if you're in the classroom, remember, we don't hear about most of the time who we've touched, who we've affected. And keep that in mind that, yeah, you know, we do have an effect on people's lives and we have a positive effect and we might not hear about it and nobody's going to give you credit for it. But just remember, you are changing the world in a positive way. And it was just a really great feeling. So, and I got to see a bunch of my other former Zemi students, which was just great. You know, a couple from a few years ago, then some other students showed up who hadn't taken my seminars, but came anyhow. And it was really just a nice experience. It was a really, really nice experience, and had, you know, some dinner afterwards, and there was a second party, and I got to spend time with people I hadn't seen in a while. So it was real nice. But I just mentioned that keep in mind that, you know, we do have a positive impact on people.
No, positive or negative. But
I'm trying to ignore the negative one.
I'm glad you had that finally at the end, because I've been saying that here for 12 years. But yeah, it's nice to be able to go out on that kind of a positive note. Good for you.
Well, just in the sense of, you know, the negative I can see usually. Hopefully. I'm scared about the negative impacts I've had that I don't hear about. But just the idea of, you know, getting that evidence.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And, yeah, it was just a really nice thing. So, yeah, so that was great. And it was nice. My wife came to the lecture, which was really kind of – it was nice. And
no, that's good.
Yeah, and I saw a bunch of students and people and other teachers came. And, yeah, and just, you know, having time to think. It's amazing how – my brain seems to have so much more space in it, although it is empty space, but it does seem to have space. But anyway, enough about that. Should we get to our topic at hand?
Yeah, yeah. You're going to delineate some of the terms for us.
Yeah. And I think the most important thing we just need to start off with is just the difference between what we mean by class, lesson, and a course.
Yeah, and it's at least for this, you know, purpose of our discussion, we really need to make the distinction, because you and I have also like stumbled over these things. And even though I don't particularly like the limitations or the actual restrictions, I think it's important that we do that.
Okay. So, because our topic today is what do you do when on the first class of a course?
There we go.
Right? There we go. So,
or lesson of a course.
Or lesson, yeah. So,
Class is the whole course that you teach. Class can be like the group of students. The class can be like one 60-minute or 90-minute session. Class is all those things. We need to make distinctions.
Okay. Well, the easy one is course.
Okay.
The course is the either semester-long segment or the year-long segment.
Okay, the 15-week or the 30-week group of lessons.
Whatever has a title, yes, yeah. Exactly. So, for example, oral English, listening and reading, that's a course, okay? And the course is made up of either, let's say, 15 or 30 classes or lessons. But what we're going to do is I think we should use the term lesson for those 15 or 30 segments. And the class, I think, here is we're going to talk about the group of students.
Okay. So when we have the problems that we're talking about today, we're talking about could be – it's a problem with the course, but the problem could be the class. It could be the students themselves. But not we're not really so much going to address the lesson, because we did that a long time ago, 2017.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. What do you do when, you know, you start teaching a lesson and it goes wrong? So it's important for – us as well as our listeners to know
what we're talking about.
We're really talking about what happens when you're in on the first day, first lesson or the second lesson, and it's like, whoa, this is not going well at all. This is not looking good. In the minimum level of an emotional reaction. So I think once we're agreed on that, right?
Right.
Okay. So Tony, I think when we were talking a little bit before today, you know, and I mentioned like one of the things that needs to be addressed before we even talk about anything is how do you know?
Yeah, yeah.
That it's gone south. So I'm just curious. I want to throw it on to you. How do you know when a class has gone off the rails in the first or after the, you know, at the first lesson or by the second lesson?
Well, the first indication is when they're not laughing at jokes, and that's either a comprehension problem or possibly a personality problem, or it's something else is bothering them that's forcing them to communicate this displeasure. The other thing that it's hard to predict, but whenever you make an announcement, like you're going to begin an activity, you're going to shift something else. The response time, the facial expressions. And when, you know, there are more, a little bit more obvious things when you put a question out to the class and there's zero response. That's most of the time. So you have to interpret, there's a matter of interpretation. It's like, how intentionally are they choosing to not answer some, and the signs of that can be a little bit more subtle. But it's usually small things, but they're, if you're looking for them, you can find them, and they're mostly in student responses to something that you're doing, or more accurately, maybe lack of response. It's like, you know, how much, you know, count the eye rolls, that type of thing. That's one of the things, a few of the things that I kind of key in on. It's like, as indicators that like, okay, something's not right. What about you?
The first thing I think is similar, right? That things like, do they react to kind of any comments, or do they respond to the jokes? Because of course I know that I'm funny. I think the main thing for me is that there's an emotional reaction I'll have, and I need to stop and pause that part of me and just say, okay, I need to identify concrete evidence, kind of like what you did, all right? Is it a slow reaction time? Are they not laughing at jokes that I know students in the past have usually laughed at? For example, what else can I see? Are they looking at their phones? Are they looking down? Are they making eye contact with me? Are they watching when I write on the board? Those would be indications of, you know, being that the students are kind of checking out. And I think what's really important here is to really focus on things that you can observe, things that you can see, and not get caught up into like internal states of saying they're not motivated or they don't like English. So it's those kinds of things. If I put them into groups, do they take a long time to stand up, gather their things, move around? When they sit down, you know, do they start talking to other students or do they not talk to other students? If I tell them that, you know, as soon as you sit down, you should do like, you know, the greetings and find out about the person, introduce yourself, talk to the person, ask some questions. And if that kind of activity ends real quickly, like they just kind of go, hi, 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 and then they go silent, then I've got an idea that there's, you know, something definitely going on.
Yeah, something's wrong.
So I think, again, focusing on the, any of those visible things you can see and not going into internal states. Right.
Right. And then you mentioned like going to the phones, but yeah, any kind of like when they, you see somebody like leaving consciousness of the classroom and like going off into some other activity, whether it's on a phone or it's on paper or sleeping or whatever it might be.
Right. And especially for any novice teachers in Japan or people who are new to teaching in Japan, your initial impression is that the class isn't working if you're used to like a more of a Western kind of classroom situation.
Absolutely.
Right.
It's a whole different set of standards.
Right. It's going to be quiet and silent and less interactive than almost anything you're used to, unless I think you're coming from some other cultures that are similar with similar student attitudes towards classroom behavior. But if you can basically make sure and say, look, this is how I feel. I have enough evidence or data points right now to know that, yes, this class is not working, and then I should revise, I think, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Now, something's got to be done.
Yeah.
It takes some action.
Okay. So I think also that I mentioned before that there's a need for a kind of a needs assessment, a needs analysis here. And Tony, you have a response to that. You have an idea about that.
Yeah. And my first thing is that we talked about different kind of needs analysis. Like, well, the needs from a teacher's perspective, that's kind of beforehand, though I always wait until I meet the students to make my final. But you're talking about like maybe the students' needs and things. But I think like when you notice something's wrong, it's like, okay, something's wrong. The easiest place, because you haven't had a chance probably to interact that much with the students yet. So look at yourself and take some really honest self-reflection. It's not easy to do. We're not always aware of what we're actually doing, how we speak, our affect, the way we walk into a classroom, our body language, everything, the tone of our voice, speed that we speak, and all those kinds of things. But taking a really good, hard look as best you can is what are you really doing in class? Not what you think you're doing, not what you're trying to do, but what is it that you're actually doing? And that might be part of what's causing this problem. Obviously, go back and revisit the syllabus. You know, you've met the students, you've written the syllabus, take a look at the two together. Is the syllabus realistic? Is it appropriate for this group of students, whether major, year, whatever it might be, school, whatever school they are? Maybe there's other issues, relevancy, for example. The student feedback that you've gotten so far, what does it tell you? Whether direct, indirect, again, the student's rolling their eyes, Sue's not paying attention. Is there any pattern that you can discern? Does it happen at sometimes more than others? Is it a particular student or group of students that's the problem? You need to kind of take a look and examine and see what's happening there. This is not a one-time thing. You kind of got to do it continually, before each class, during each class, after each class, because it's a dynamic situation. It's like no lesson is a state of stasis. It's constantly changing. It's always dynamic. So watch for different reactions at different times, something that you're doing, something that the students are reacting to. Try to suss all those kinds of things out. There's a lot of things that you might find out that really have nothing to do with your class. This has happened to me several times over the years. It's after lunch class or it's a fourth period class and the students are off. And, it's sometimes as simple as saying, hey, what's with you guys? And you might find out it's like, yeah, our third period class, it's terrible. And they all come into your class dragging that black cloud in with them. And it's got nothing to do with you. For me, it was like, they all had a gym class, which was way at the other end of campus. And they had to rush and hustle. And when they showed up my class, they were out of breath, sweaty. And, if you're not aware of that, you can, make the wrong prescription. It's like, we need to be more active in this class. It's like, they're already tired. Let's maybe do something else. So there might be other things outside of your class, lesson, class, this week class, that might be affecting that. There's things that we might know, and there's things that we will never know. You want to maybe look at your materials that you're using, whether it's a textbook itself, whether it's auxiliary materials that you're using, in terms of relevance. Do they mean something to the kids? Is the stuff engaging as best as you can guess for them? It wasn't a terrible textbook, but it was not the right textbook for the students that I was teaching, but I had no choice. And there was a video. There's a lot of videos with this, and which I used in very different ways. And I can't remember exactly, and it's probably a good thing, the manufacturer, but it was a lesson that was tying in things about the environment. And the video was about an automaker, and it was touting all the environmental measures that were being taken by this manufacturer, and it was basically a commercial for the car company, and so that's the tack I took with the students because this video was not difficult for them, And it wasn't particularly interesting. It was pretty dry. But taking this other spin, and I says, well, what do you guys see that's wrong with this? Anything weird about this? And a couple of kids just say, yeah, exactly. This is propaganda. This is commercial. This is an advertisement for the car company. And they loved it. They flipped them all around. So reevaluating materials, and you know, if you can change the materials, okay, try changing and see if that helps. If you're stuck with the materials, a textbook, maybe spin it and use it a different way. Something to do. Sometimes it's inappropriate. It's either too mature or not mature enough for the students that you've got. Again, depends what you got. And, you know, last thing is like, is it fun? Fun is not a crime. I always tell my students, is like, I hate studying. Studying is not fun. Learning, on the other hand, is and should be fun. And so let's work toward that. And I would always try to engage them with that endeavor. So that's the kind of maybe the beginning to kind of things to look at that maybe are within your control and that you can change or not.
Yeah, the physical part, you know, the period part, the time thing. I always laugh about that because I remember when I first started it, my last job, there was a meeting and we're talking about what period to have schedule a class. Mm-hmm. I must have said this one time before, maybe. I can't remember because it was one of these really funny moments. But we're saying, okay, well, what period should we schedule the class? And one of the professors says, don't do the first period class because the students are sleepy. They're trying to get to school. And everybody goes, oh, yeah, good point. And then another professor says, don't do it second period because they're hungry right before lunch. And everybody goes, yeah, that's a really good point. And another professor says, don't do it third period because they're sleepy after lunch. And everybody's like, oh, that's a really good point. And then the other professor says, can't do it fourth period because they're tired from the day. So, right. You know, any period is bad.
I had that discussion in a job interview once. Well, actually, they had the discussion. I was just listening, amused.
Mm. Right. There's no good period. But
right.
The points that you just said, it's like trying to find out, you know, maybe it's they had a bad class or, you know, for example, they have a lot of homework that day or there's a lot of tests. But since we're talking about the beginning of a course – and students are usually pretty fresh in the year. I'm not sure how much that's really affecting them. But here's the thing, is that they're not going to tell you. They're not going to volunteer the information.
Sometimes.
I'd say, yeah, sometimes, rarely, closer to rarely than to sometimes, and definitely nowhere near often. But
I don't know. I've had surprising success. It's like, especially, you know, before class, if you've got like this problem class, you have the students who sit in the front and I ask them, what the hell? I've been surprised because I would expect them not to say anything. I've been surprised at how honest they've been. I've gotten incredible information for those dweebs that sit in the front.
Okay.
They've been my angels. They've given me some incredible information.
All right.
Yeah, you can't ask the class and say, okay, what's going on? Of course, you're going to get silence.
Okay, well, that was...
But I press those kids in the front.
Okay,
well... they're my babies.
This is where I was going to go next, which is usually they're not going to volunteer, almost never. But
right.
If you're there before class starts and a student is sitting in the front or something, you can ask them. They'll give you information. Or just start up a conversation if you see a student and, you know, they are, you know, let's say, like, for example, when students have Macs, you know, MacBooks, you know.
Yeah.
And I'll say, oh, do you know this shortcut? And I'll start a little conversation and say, so, you know, what class do you have before this? Are you in class with other people? How do you feel about the class? But the best thing I really think to do is, let's say you feel like the class isn't going anywhere. Just set up an anonymous, like, Google form or something.
Sure.
And just ask students, you know, what do you like so far? What do you not like so far? And that way you can get...
What do you want more of?
Right,
what do you want less of?
Exactly. But if you don't ask the majority of students, you're not going to get an answer, I think. But as you say, it's really valuable for the kids or the students who are sitting in front. You can do that. And But before we even go on to the students and asking them questions, I think the first thing you've got to really do is you, and not even in about being honest with yourself, but by the way, when you talked about that self-honesty, and it might be, you know, your affect or something you're doing, I cannot emphasize enough how valuable it is, if it's possible, to get like a colleague or somebody just to come in and watch you for 5 minutes, or come into the class for 5 minutes and watch. And, or, you know, a former student who you know, who you trust, just have somebody come in and watch you and ask them, what do they see? Get some feedback. So, and I've got, that's been really helpful for me at times. But what the thing though, that I think you really need to start with are physical factors. And again, as you said, it's like, what time is the class? What's happening beforehand? But the layout of that room can have an incredible effect.
Yes. We talked about that long time ago, but it's no less true now than it was then. Absolutely.
But that's, I think, the starting point, is to look at the layout of the room and say, okay, let's say, as I call it, the terror of fixed desks, you know, the lecture kind of hall. Lecture room where it's really hard for students to move around, and it's already created this separation between you and them. Okay.
Yep.
There's the quality of the room. Is it like an old room that's falling apart, or is it a nice room that's clean and nice? Does it have reasonably comfortable chairs? For example, I once was in a classroom where it was a, let's see if I can describe this properly, but it's separate chairs that have the desk that you lift up to get in, and then you pull the desk part down so you can sit in the chair and put your materials there. But this was a full-size desk, so that anytime you wanted students to move, they had to completely clear everything off of top of the desk part, and then they could lift the desk to move, and then they could move around. You know, is it an easy room to move around, especially if you're doing a lot of group work? How many students is it? Is the room really crowded, or is it just too sparse, right? There's not enough density to generate energy. Where is that classroom compared, as you pointed out, compared to other classrooms? Is it a long way for them to come? Is it a noisy or quiet classroom? Is there construction going on during the day, right? We've talked about these things before.
Well, yes, we did. Yeah,
so the first thing you've got to just do is you've got to analyze the physical space. And if you're in a room that, for example, has fixed chairs and you're not a lecturing person, or the room's too big, or there's bad acoustics, do whatever you can to change the room. All right. And if you can't, you know, dealing with like a lecture space is, you got to try to be more creative with things, and maybe, you know, create groups so that students sit with groups, and you automatically create secondary groups where they know to go with, and that they have locations and things to do with. But get the physical analysis, for lack of a better term, out of the way, and figure out what you can do. Then I think, you know, we've talked about, you know, what are you doing, and the self-honesty aspect, right? And I think something else you want to think about in what is a big problem that I have is the usually right away what's causing the problem is the student level problem. That, I don't know. I mean, then there's dynamics also, of course, but I want to go into dynamics a little bit later, you know, how the students are interacting with each other, you know, et cetera. But I find that a lot of times when a course is just going off the rails, it's really because of the student level, right? That I've, you know.
The range is too wide. Yeah. From the lows to the high. Yeah, it's just crazy.
That's the worst one is when you have, you know, let's say even in an advanced class, we've talked about this before, that the variation between my top student and let's say my weakest student in an advanced class is probably bigger than the difference or variation between an advanced and intermediate class.
Yeah, the range is so wide, there is no happy medium.
Exactly.
And you can't, there is no target to hit.
Right.
It's impossible.
Right. And that's a problem with streaming. And I've been in situations where, you know, I'm convinced, like, I've wanted to go to people and say, I think there's something wrong with your assessment instrument. You know, that that how you stream. Because my argument always was, why don't we just ask students how motivated they are and stream them by motivation? Which is really terrible if you get the unmotivated class. But, you know, that happens all the time anyhow, right?
Yeah.
You could even have an advanced Sportos. Class that's not motivated. But the point is that the worst situation you can have is, I think, the mixed class, where there's just such a huge gap between the top and the bottom. Okay. But what I'm going to do – so when you have that is – you know, when you have a mixed situation, you got to be really, really creative. There's nothing you can do. And the things that I think might work is you have to, like, create learning groups so that, you know, students are learning together as groups. And these are, you know, groups that maintain themselves through the semester, through the course.
Yep.
And you make sure that there's at least one really good student, and you make sure that there's at least one weak student, and then the rest are intermediate, and you tell them that their grades is based on individual and group performance. Right. And you've got to, and here's something that's really important if you do this.
Very effective in Japan, that.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's, yeah, we've talked about that before. Some of the studies about how the importance of, you know, making sure that everyone comes up to the same level. But if you put students into groups like this, it's really important that you're very clear with students that you're not grading on a curve. You have to take out that competitive aspect from the classroom. And you just say, you know, because think about it, right? Why would a student help?
Sure, absolutely. Why would I why would I help this guy? He's just going to lower my grade.
This guy, yeah, or this guy's going to actually help me get a better grade. So you have to say that there's no curve and that, you know, as many students as, you know, you can will get the, you know, high grades, and that your grade is based on, you know, how well your group does. And you explain to students that part of, you know, learning is not that it's just how well you learn, but it's how well you can help others. And so this is one way of developing that. The other thing that's really key when you're in this really terrible situation is you need lots of mini activities. And when I say mini activities, I just mean activities that are shorter than the usual activities. They're not like – you don't want to do like 20, 25-minute activities here. You really need to have like 5, 7-minute activities, and that are constantly switching and moving so that students, you know, are refreshed and that they're, you know, getting challenged at the same time. And that the goals, what they're trying to accomplish in these mini activities, are available to them. And again, the advanced students can help the weaker students, et cetera. So,
yeah, that's very hard for the teacher, but it's very effective because it doesn't give the students a chance to get bored. They've moved their seats, they got a new group, they start a new task, boom, 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 boom. Okay, change it up. That is a very effective way of keeping that class engaged. They can't help it. They've got to move around. They got to talk to other people. Moving things around quickly like that is a very good way to keep folks engaged.
And to stop them from sleeping. But those, that is like the real difficult situation, I think, is that mixed one. Or, you know, when there's no streaming at all. Some places do have no streaming. So there's that. The too high situation, you know, when you've like, you've figured, okay, this is what I do. This is what I've done in the past with this course. And then suddenly a bunch of students come in and, you know, they're just too high. Their level's way above what you had shot for. What do you do in that situation?
That's actually very interesting. I'm sure I've told the story on the podcast before, but that's exactly what happened to me. I had been teaching at, like, you know, normal, average universities in Japan, and began a new job at a much higher level university, Japan, a foreign language university in Japan, one of the top 10. And, you know, I'd make my syllabus and things and for what I was used to, and did my first day spiel, and the students were polite, quiet. I was talking to them way below their level. I got done, you know, trying not to intimidate, make it easy, allay their fears, trying just, okay, I'm not going to hurt you guys. And I said, are there any questions? And, you know, of course, my expecting it's like no one's going to raise their hand. A guy in the back of the room raises his hand and says, oh, yeah, sure, go ahead. Have you ever regretted becoming a teacher? What do? I got to go home and rewrite the syllabus. This is what I did. Because obviously, this class is going to be very different from anything that I've taught before. And, it, you know, it worked out fine. Luckily, bless his soul, he straightened me out on the first day, and it was all on me. Well, maybe the people who hired me, maybe give me a little heads up on what I was into. But, yeah, I said, okay, we're just going, all right, this is what I was going to do. I'm not going to do. I understand a little bit better what you guys need, and it turned out great. But I was just lucky, and I got that anvil dropped on my head on the first day, and I went home and did my homework, and it worked out.
Yeah, what if you hadn't found that out on the first day?
Well, I'm pretty sure I would have found it.
It does come out.
The second week. But that by itself would have had maybe such a negative impact on the rest of the semester, right? So it was just luck, pure dumb luck, that I got that on the first day and I was able to bounce back by the second week.
Yes. Yeah, but I would say that I think the funny part about that is, as you said, it was the student in the back of the room.
Yeah, yeah.
Not the front. So that's funny. But in all honesty, this is the best situation you can have,
mm-hmm.
right? Even if the textbook is too low, it doesn't matter. Because this one's an
easy. You can always step it up.
You can easily, up the game in that kind of class, because you're going to have a lot more discussions, small group work, small group presentation. You can focus, for example, on working on, question asking skills after people do presentations, right? Reporting on what they hear. That's not a problem at all, I think.
Right, right. As long as you're aware of it.
Right. And that again goes back to making sure from the first lesson that you run some kind of tests, right? You kind of do that.
Yeah, structured or unstructured, formal or informal, whether you've got actual, paper or online tests that you do, but it's your own head, your own checklist. It's okay. What happened here? What happened here? What happened here? What happened here? You gotta do that on your feet on the first day.
Right. Yes. And I think most teachers have, as we've said before, have little things that they do, their opening day spiel. And you watch reactions and
consciously or unconsciously, right? You get the class ends and some people are more structured and more concrete than others, but yeah, we all do that to a certain extent, but it can be so much more effective if it's conscious and focused.
Mm-hmm. Right. And now we get to the really hard one, which is what do you do when you've overshot or overrated what the students are capable of doing? So you've gotten a textbook and you've made your syllabus, you've got your lesson plan set up, and you realize, this is way beyond what the students are capable of doing based on their language skills for a variety of reasons. And what do you do there? That's a tough one, I think. That's a tough one. Not as tough as the mixed class.
As the mixed classes? Yeah. They're maybe just as hard. I think at that point, you need to look really closely at the students, as I always say, because it's often not just the level, but there's more to it. So, for example, when you look at teacher assistance sites and web things, they'll say, well, make it more interactive, increase the activity. They say, well, yeah, maybe there should be more, maybe there should be less. If you got advanced motivative students, motivated students that are used to independent learning, yeah, more interaction is probably going to be the recipe, right? That's really going to be good. On the other hand, especially with students who are lower level, it's like where you're overshot. Maybe those students, especially in that situation, need to be taught in a more conventional Japanese way that they're more comfortable with. You don't want to hit them with more independence and more interaction because they're just going to drown. And I had this problem. The university where we worked together after you left and the university changed and we had students who were suddenly of a much lower caliber than we were used to. And I went in the next year teaching the way that I had there successfully for a number of years. And just the situation you just described, it's like these kids just were not ready for that. I had to, you know, I was floundering. I didn't know what to do. I had to experiment, tried different things, and I had to let them teach me how they needed to be taught. And what we ended up doing, which until then, years before, it all had been small classes, interactive, very structured, vocabulary-based, great progress, great success. Suddenly, it was a different school. And they were miserable. 3 weeks into it, maybe a little bit more, I'm frustrated. I'm ready to give up. I said, okay, I give up. I can't teach you guys. What we're going to do is, you know, we've got this, the textbook's got a dialogue. I want you to use this as an example. I'm going to put you guys into a dialogue or a conversation, groups, two or three, four people, whatever, based on whatever the lesson was. I said, you guys make your own, memorize it, be ready to perform it. When you finish it, you go home. They were happy as clams. They tried so hard. One of the students in that class who didn't say a word in any of her other English classes, we were doing like a grocery buying thing. It says, oh, mommy, what did you buy? She said, she responded. She says, I bought bread. This is one of my great successes. Mommy said, I bought bread. And I went back to the teacher's room ecstatic. It's like, hey, I let them teach me how they needed to be taught. And it wasn't great. I mean, again, this is really down in the lower levels, but it was one of those cases where the teacher, I had completely overshot their abilities, had to completely regroup, go back to the beginning, rebuild, build something else. And one of the guys in that class, a couple of years later, I had left the school by then, but he came back from one of the other teachers, I was told, came back looking for me. After that, a year or two after, he went to the United States and hitchhiked from reverse Route 66 from Los Angeles to Chicago. And he came back to the school because he wanted to tell me a story.
That's nice.
So, yeah. It was really nice to hear. But yeah, that group of kids that I thought was hopeless, that I was never going to be able to reach them. By the end of the year, we were clicking and connecting. It was like, it wasn't the teaching that I thought was good or, you know, but for them, that was the best and it worked. So anyway, there's that story. But again, a lot of times they'll just play, you know, people will recommend more interactivity. Sometimes what they need is less. It's that interaction sometimes for some students is too stressful, too demanding. They're not ready for it. But they're ready to do what they've been taught in high school. And yeah, maybe we quote unquote know that's not the best way to learn a foreign language. For them, maybe that's what they need. And sometimes that's what you have to do. Same thing with tech, right? They need more tech or maybe they need less. It depends on the group that you're teaching, right? And a lot of it depends on you, how confident you are using tech in the classroom. Again, we talk about what are you really doing and what do they see? What do they perceive you doing? And if you're not comfortable using the technology, they're going to pick that up. They're going to pick that up. And at the same time, you're really gung-ho. If they're not into it, they're going to resist. There was another teacher that long ago, and he was really gung-ho on the tech. And he went to the classroom. He had gadgets hanging all over his belt and stuff. And, you know, I'd been teaching at this university for a while, and this is like, I get it, guy. But these aren't the kids for that. It's not going to work. And I said, I felt a little bit sorry for him. But he never gave up. He kept doing it. But I never observed one of his classes, so I don't know what was happening. But it was wild. So yeah, sometimes interactivity is the answer. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes tech is the answer. Sometimes it's not. It really depends on that individual situation. And that's the thing with all the things we're discussing. These are the outliers. It's a norm, quote unquote, normal class. You can just go in and do your normal thing and things will generally be okay. We're talking about when something is off, something is different, something is not working, and it's often a big black box. But anyway, with that tech and the interaction, it's like, yeah, sometimes more, sometimes less. You never know.
Yes, that's why it's an art. You know, while you were talking about that, and I was thinking about what you did and what you didn't do or what people can do, I was thinking about research. And Tony, it's kind of a segue here, something going off to the side, going sideways. But I have you ever seen any research that like says like, you know, that this has a this if you do this, it has a 70% probability of succeeding?
No.
Right. In other words, you know, it'll say that 70% of the students, you know, in the experiment had an increase in their level. But I realized what I'm talking about is a kind of a nuanced difference, right?
Right. It's one thing to describe what happened. It's another thing to predict what's going to happen.
Right. And, you know, that would be just so really useful if somebody, you know, came out and said, okay, in this situation, if you did this, we can predict that it's 80% of the time it's going to work. That would be such a wonderful way to approach, you know, the experiments and the research. But I want to go.
It's professional suicide.
Yes. Okay. All right. Yes. Well, that's another podcast by itself, professional suicide. But I want to go back to what you were saying about, you know, how that one class and how you changed it and you went back to more of a traditional learning model, and that helped them feel comfortable. It was right in their wheelhouse, so to speak. It was
they knew what to do.
And possibly what's caused the problem for them, as you pointed out, is that they didn't know what to do. So one thing you can do in that situation, and I've done this before where I've, you know, for example, I have highly interactive classes, or I believe my classes are student-centered, is you can go back to a model they're used to and slowly introduce little right. by little, which is probably what you ended up doing, I'm going to guess.
That's what I – exactly.
Right? It wasn't just the same thing.
Very little. Yes. But we moved in that direction. Absolutely.
Right. So there what's really key is how much to introduce at one time. And yeah. In my experience, it tells me a little bit is better than too much.
Yes.
Right? So you yep. have them, for example, memorize the dialogue, and then you have them do that a couple of times and, you know, over a couple of lessons. And then
you reward all their creativity. So when they think they're being like wise guys and they're trying to make it funny and they're just like, looking for your reaction, it's like, that's great. Man, that's fantastic. Excellent.
Yes.
And they go and they leave the classroom and they're happy.
Right. And that's an important thing that we haven't addressed yet, which is in those situations when the class isn't working in the first or the second or the course, right? And the last first or two lessons, said we're not rewarding the positive behaviors enough, I think.
Yeah.
And how you do that in Japan, you have to be kind of careful about, I think. You know.
Yeah, because they feel bad if you praise them too much.
Right. And so as the student walks out, just say, hey, that was really funny. I really like that. But one of the things I want to just kind of go back to is that – so you point out that do things that they're comfortable with because there's a chance that the class isn't working because they feel uncomfortable or they don't know what to do. And so always remember that there's a training period involved where you have to be really patient, where you are teaching them, for example, you know, how to do certain things. And it might be something as basic as write down your homework in your calendar. Okay.
Yeah. It's something that seems, you know, totally unnecessary to explain. No, it's essential to explain because it's not obvious to them.
Right. And one of the things that I think is easy to forget, and I constantly forget this, and then I constantly remind them because once I remember that I've forgotten it, is that there's a lot of learned dependency there. You know, there a lot of these students are coming from high school, and this happens in college where the teachers give them handouts that are pre-made. Everything that they need to do for, you know, for a test is already on a piece of paper. The teacher teachers send reminders and things. For example, again, they believe that if they're absent, they don't have to do homework. So there's a lot of basic things you have to introduce. So a lot of times being clear with your expectations and then reminding them, gentle reminders, you know, in the beginning of the course to help them remember that they're responsible for things. But that's, you know, we're talking about level things and content things. I think one of the things that's truly scary is what, you know, the dynamic one where it's like, it seems like these students don't like each other.
Yes, it's very real. Yeah. That's very real. And I've had a lot of those classes.
Right.
And that's a little bit harder.
Yes. And one of the things that if you can identify it, and one of the ways you identify that is you have to run some, like, you know, assessments, instruments, right? Check their vocabulary, check their grammar, how well they can speak, et cetera. And a lot of times it might be because they're from different departments or there might be, for example, you might have first-year students with some third-year students, and that's a real uncomfortable thing for both the first-year students and the third-year students, et cetera. But here's my experience tells me that if I come to the conclusion that it's not a levels problem, or if it is a levels problem and I can account and, you know, deal with the levels problem, and I'm pretty much reduced it down to, you know, this seems like a dynamics problem. It's a matter of, you know, the individual personalities in this class. And a lot of teachers are going to have problems with this, but my suggestion is put your content on hold immediately. Because if you've got a problem where it's the classroom dynamics and it's the people in the classroom, you have got to focus on getting them comfortable with each other. Your content is now a distant second place. I think that's a hard thing for a lot of teachers to do because there's so much pressure for us to get through things. Here's what you have to do. But you're not going to get through it if it's a dynamic problem. So if it's you've ascertained that it's a dynamic problem, what you got to do is you're going to spend a lot of your time with icebreakers. And by icebreakers, I mean activities that help people get comfortable with each other. These can be games. This can be things, for example, like find someone who, playing number games like Buzz, for example, where everything is low stakes and it involves people just kind of saying hi to each other and doing things with each other. Focus on a lot of fun games and activities that they can do so they can again get comfortable. And there's so many games available online. And, you know, activities that they can do, for example, there's the old game. I haven't played it in a long time, but Fruit Basket, where students run across the room. And those games and activities are real helpful. Make sure you're doing lots of pair and group changing during the class. So again, you know, during the icebreakers or when you're doing team building, that there's a lot of repetition. They get to do the things once or twice, so they're developing competency. And they're changing, so they're not with the same people. And the more that they, you know, work with other people, even if they don't like each other, they're going to kind of get desensitized. And they'll be more comfortable. And another thing I found that's really helpful is to play music that they like. You know?
Well, I always play music that I like.
Well,
because I don't want to listen to the music that they like.
Well, here's what I'm – you see, this is
– But you were right. I know what you're saying.
Okay, let me finish.
We all have our limits.
But you know where I'm going with this, which is
yes.
In a class where it's not a dynamic problem, I play the music I like. I have no problem with that.
Okay, good.
Gotcha. You know, and it's like, yeah, I tell my students, I go, look, you know, we can have music in the class and I'm going to play what I like and you don't have to listen to it if you don't want. But when there's a problem with the students and the dynamics and I can't get the atmosphere or the environment that I want, I play the music that they like and it makes a difference to them. Right?
And yeah, some kind of common thing that they share.
Yes. And I have to admit that, you know, that when I was, you know, younger, many, many years ago, and the teacher would bring in their music, and, you know, I was born in 1958. So when, you know, the teacher brought in Frank Sinatra when we were in junior high school, we didn't, you know, particularly appreciate it. And I realized that my music is to my students what, you know, Frank Sinatra back then was to me. But it's worthwhile keeping track of the pop charts.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's also worth track, if you can, finding out, like, what's the cool, not the popular group, but what group is considered really cool for being, like, good musicians, for example. Because what happens is there'll be, you know, four or five students in a 30-student class who will go, whoa, this teacher knows this group.
And, yeah. They'll give you some cred.
Now, the other thing is that when we talk about dynamics, I'm talking about the dynamics between students. The really terrible one is the dynamic between you and the students. You know, when your personality doesn't match up with the classroom personality.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that's really key here is that you can try changing them by, you know, with the activities and everything. But if that doesn't work, you have no choice but to change.
Yeah.
So just keep that in mind. But
yeah, you got to put a different mask on. You got to play a different persona.
Okay. Yeah, and the last thing I just want to do is go to what happens if the class is okay, it's not a dynamics problem, the level's good, but you chose the wrong textbook. And, you know, again, you have an undershooting and an overshooting there. And actually it's easier if the textbook is, I don't know.
Too low.
Cause
you can, always build it up.
Right.
You can always make it more difficult.
Right. Exactly. You can add it.
But if it's too difficult, it goes lost. It's just falling on the floor.
Right. So what do you do in those situations?
I use a textbook as little as possible and just supplement my butt. you do the bare minimum with the textbook, break it down, make it as simple as possible, create new exercises, scan the passages from the textbook and like make a simpler version. Now it's much easier with GPT, things like that. So offer them alternate versions of the stories, make the demands of, you know, comprehension just much less demanding. Supplement with other things. So get rid of the textbook, you know, to cover as least as you need to, and then move on to other things, you know, related structures, related content. But it's like, yeah, it's more work, but that's the way it is. So yeah, if it's your environment, then you find something that's like more appropriate level with the same topic, hopefully the same vocabulary, tweak it if you need to. Yeah, it's a lot more work. It's worth it.
Right. And one of the things is that, you know, if the students have bought the textbook and, you know, sometimes, you know, the students don't care if you don't use the textbook.
Yeah.
Right. They treat the textbook purchase as something that's just part of what they do.
Yeah, but some of them get upset exactly. if you don't use a textbook.
Some of them will too. So in that situation, figure out the minimal use of the textbook. And, you know, again, you're going to have to do lots of scaffolding. And again, as I agree with you that, you know, use the textbook as a basis and maybe, you know, make sure you identify what vocabulary they need. Also, make sure it's very possible that it's a background knowledge issue. Do they know enough about the topic? So provide them with more information and use multimedia, you know, different kinds of media.
But you mentioned the vocabulary, and that's a really big one. So, yeah, you comb through the unit and, like, you know, the textbook might have its own vocabulary exercises and things, but you might need to do more. You might like to go a little bit deeper, a little more. But you can't lose with, like, bolstering the vocabulary. It'll help them with the comprehend the unit, and it'll help them overall if it's, like, above their level.
Right. And if you're not familiar with how to do that, there's, you know, and the idea is that you go through and you – let's say you identify what you intuitively think are words they might not know. There are websites where you can – you know, put text in and find out what level that vocabulary is, what, you know, 1,000 word level. And I think we've talked about this before about how vocabulary works.
Sure.
But if you've tested their vocabulary and you know what their basic level is, you can then, you know, create a substitute word list for them.
Yep.
And that will help them understand. And that, I think, actually is maybe the most effective intervention you can do if a textbook is over their heads.
And GPT is great for that. You can like copy the textbook text, put it in GPT so they make this at X level and then like at Y level and then, you know, bridge it all along. Yeah, it's fantastic.
And here's the thing too is that, right, when you do that, there are specific ways to do that. There's, you know, the prompts, how you set them. But you can then also create multiple levels of that.
Right. And then
you can then provide that to the students and make sure you include your copyright notices that, you know, this is a copyrighted material. And then give it to students at multiple levels so they can start at the basic level. And that is a helpful thing. And that's one of maybe the best uses of ChatGPT or any large language model right now is the ability to come up with that differentiated learning model. And we haven't talked about that because that actually does change things in the mixed classes. And we didn't really talk about that. But
well, that's another topic another day because I've used that before the ChatGPT, but like to have alternate levels of readings for students. And that's they love it.
Yeah, I think that's like, for example, breakingnews.com might be the website that has like multiple levels of
maybe that's the what same I was text. Using. Yeah.
But most of it is really how long it is.
Well, but, it's a sentence length, vocabulary, and length. Yeah, all of that.
So you're changing vocabulary and then rewriting into maybe simpler, you know, sentences and things. And there's also the other thing you can just do is, you know, by like numbering a text for your students.
Yep.
And identifying like in a text, let's say they're doing a reading passage, here is the topic sentence, here is the topic sentence. So there's things you can do, but the thing is that it's a lot of work. If you, you know, if the level is too low for the students, that's just, you know, that's just an easy thing to fix.
Yeah.
Right. As you say,
easy.
Presentations, do research on this topic.
Yeah, here's a link to a relevant article.
Right.
Go at it.
Right.
Discuss.
Report, summarize the article, then report to a friend. So you give, you know, one student this chapter one introduction, another student gets chapter two introduction. I think everybody's.
Yeah, and include 2-3 errors, have the other group just. You know, identify the errors.
Right. Argue,
all kinds of fun stuff.
That's the like almost the best situation, right? Because you can say, okay, we're not going to use a textbook, right? And everybody's like, yay. So those are, I think, some things that can be done, and there's some concrete things. So don't despair. There's things you can do, but there is a good chance that no matter what you do, ain't gonna work.
It ain't gonna work. We're running short on time, but can I run through a couple of fast options here?
Please.
Okay. So in addition, so when you get like students, like how to get them involved and engaged, especially when you talked about like the different levels, but not only different levels, but like different majors, different things, give them different options on how they will be evaluated. So give them a choice. Do a written report, do an oral presentation, individual or group, do some other kind of project, or a test. Let them choose. And giving them that autonomy and that control over their learning is sometimes a magic spark that really gets them involved. Even if it's something as simple as like whatever topic, you know, choose a topic. You know, like a lot of times I taught, you know, intercultural communications. We did a different topic every week. It's like choose one and then do one of those things with the topic of your choice. Giving them that control. Individual for the people like me or people who are a little more extroverted, a group project type of thing. That choice process will bring that extra engagement. Bringing relevance. So we talked about like, you know, for example, textbooks that were too easy and things. So yeah, I've had that situation. It's like, well, make it, you know, so they're talking about, you know, the environment, like, automobiles and pollution. Say, okay, make it more, like, bring it back. Okay, how about on this campus? What do you see that the university is doing that is not environmentally conscientious? What are they doing wrong? Or what is this university doing right about like the environment and things? How about your neighborhood, where you come from? That environment, that city, your laws, the practices there, what's happening? A lot of times textbooks and teachers like making foreign connections. That's great if the majors in that university are encouraging and attracting students who are like outward bound. But for students who are planning on never leaving Japan, that's probably not going to be primary interest. It's like sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. It's not an automatic panacea. Make it relevant to what the students' interests are. It's also sometimes interesting to compare and contrast content with the Japanese context. So sometimes in intercultural things, but not always, just say with English things. Like a lot of times with textbooks, you're reading stories. They're based in England, Australia, the United States, and Canada. It doesn't hurt to sometimes show that you understand, but make the connections like, okay, this is why it's interesting because that's how they do it there. This is how we do it in Japan. And that kind of bridging can sometimes be helpful. For like students who are lack confidence or not really sure what's happening, regular and frequent low or zero risk assessments like quizzes, tasks, weekly things helps them get that frequent feedback. So it's like, okay, yes, I'm on the right track. I know what I'm doing. And this is what I need to do on the final exam so they know what to expect, because a lot of times they're really lost and they really don't know what to do. Make sure that you know, with the class, it's like connect it to their world, but also make sure that it's connected to how they're going to be finally evaluated and explain that to them. And like we hinted at it a little bit around like in the last hour. It's like, to really explain explaining the connection, what you're doing in class, what you're doing in assignments, how that's going to relate to the final assessment, test, or whatever it's going to be, that needs to be explained clearly. It needs to be explained really clearly. We think the connection is obvious or very close to obvious. Very often to the students, it's not. It really needs to be delineated in detail because they don't get it. I think maybe that's all I got.
Okay. And I'm just going to tack one thing onto the end of that, which is, you know, make sure that you're taking into account the introverts in your class and the extroverts.
Yay!
Right? Because, you know, for some introverts, group work is hell.
Yeah.
And I was a student, I mean, I do group work all the time with my students, but I hated group work when I was a student. I was just always, can I just do this by myself, please? It just wasn't as much fun.
That's what I mean. Like the set options, right? The grading options. Like
exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Give those introverts an out.
Right. But just to make sure that, you know, you structure it so that when you're doing group activities that, you know, you figure out ways that, you know, someone who doesn't like group work is not going to get penalized or isn't going to feel too uncomfortable. So it's a hard thing to do, but the easiest solution that I have always found is group work, do short group work, you know, 5 to 10 minutes, let's say, and then individual work. Then back to a short group work thing and then individual work. Or really useful and helpful, I think, for introverts, at least there seems to be evidence for this, is planning time. Have people have time to prepare before they go into a group. You know, what do you want to talk about in the group? What are the answers to these questions? Now go ahead and go into the group and share your answers. I think that's another way to deal with the introvert problem. But we're over. This is one of our longer podcasts.
Yeah, we're long. We're long.
We've gone over. So we're just going to wind this up, aren't we?
Wind it up.
Wind it up. Okay. I'm Charles Wiz.
Tony Silva.
And we're two teachers talking, and you know where to find us. Okay, right. Tony.
Okay, man. Enjoy that retirement.
Yes, yes. And enjoy your continuing retirement.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Now we're going to have to change it to two retired teachers talking. All right. Be well, Tony.
All righty, man.
Bye.